Welcome to the 122nd episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 66 years to the day that the greatest all-rounder in cricketing history made his Test debut. The 17-year-old Gary Sobers made unremarkable scores of 14 and 26, but his off-spin did produce the best bowling figures of the game, with 4 for 75. And in what must surely be a unique story, Trevor Bailey, the first batsman he dismissed, went on to become Sobers' biographer.
In this episode, we have, as usual, a dive into the past and an update of some of the things that have been keeping us amused over the last little while. Andy's going to be talking to us about the hit the ball twice dismissal, which is, I have to say, one that I haven't really thought about since I was playing cricket at school. We're going to be reviewing the film The Cricket Kings of Queens. And as ever, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do hop onto iTunes and give us a rating and a review. It's a great way of other people finding out about what we do. The first thing, though, is to talk about a retirement that's come about before the season has even begun.
Well, I would forgive you for having missed this retirement, because obviously the news has been somewhat hectic. But English off-spinner Ollie Rayner announced his retirement last week. A 6'5" spinner with an elegant orthodox action. I always enjoyed watching him at Lord's. I think I've always enjoyed watching tall spinners. I mean, I'm sort of tall myself, but there's always been something slightly improbable.
I don't enjoy watching you, to be honest.
No, I forgive you for that. But there's something about the kind of slightly improbable mechanics of a tall spinner that I've always enjoyed. And his retirement brought back one of my favourite county cricket memories, which was from a glorious September afternoon back in 2013. And I often watch county cricket in September because it's often that part time of the year where you panic and you're like, God, the season's running out. I've got to get some cricket in. Surrey needed a win for their survival hopes and had produced a lively turning track, which backfired pretty spectacularly. Rayner took 15 wickets for Middlesex and was close to unplayable. I reckon it's one of the most dominant bowling performances I've ever seen live, and I think it was particularly enjoyable because it felt very well deserved for a county pro who's had his fair amount of disappointment.
Was it the kind of bowling spell where, you know, the wickets came amidst runs, or was it really the batsman tied down, bamboozling, scratching around? Do you remember that?
It was pretty relentless. So the one player who played wonderfully for Surrey was Hashim Amla, who defied Rayner. Wonderful player of spin. And, you know, completely unperturbed when balls kind of like occasionally sort of leapt over his head or did mad things. And I think it's one of those moments where you realise what a nonsense averages and sort of high scores can sometimes be. Because I don't even know if Amla made that many in that day, but it just, you know, played wonderfully. And so Rayner is in some ways, I guess, can risk being remembered as a bit of a nearly man, but that's probably a little bit unfair. He played a key role in Middlesex's famous 2016 championship triumph and played plenty for the England Lions, but never quite got into the England team. He suffered the fate of many English spinners in that captains repeatedly saw him as an option to hold an end up rather than an attacking threat in his own right. And the funny thing is, in 2016 he had Adam Vosges as his Middlesex captain, and who trusted him and sort of let him go and let him attack, and he had great success. Rayner's quite a vocal figure, and he spoke out several times publicly about the need to give English spinners a proper chance. You know, he was particularly resentful of the fact that, you know, the way our seasons often work with a lot of county cricket piled at the start of the season was made it very tough for them. And I think there could be no better legacy for his career if a few captains out there actually listened.
And I think it encapsulates this story, actually, one of the issues with England spinning over the last few years, which has been that in a desire to get four-day gate receipts, there have been, you know, batsman-friendly pitches rather than spinner-friendly pitches in the county championship. And that anecdote that you told about the September 2013 game is a great indication of when you, produce a turning track, what a spinner like Rayner can do.
Yes, and I think this trust is so much of it, isn't it? The way you can transform a player by just saying, I think you're great, well, you know, lead our attack, go and get it done. Now, I was incredibly jealous of the fact that you have been playing cricket, because I must admit, this all feels a very long, long way at the moment.
It does. The world's a bit topsy-turvy, isn't it? So the weekend before last, we did, for the side that I play for, my work side, we squeezed in one last Sunday of cricket. And it was quite a memorable day for a few reasons. So throughout this season, we've had a whole lot of games that have been, you know, put off at the last moment because of rain, but none so far that have been put off at the last moment because of pandemic. And I don't think any of us have really been in that situation before. The Sunday fell in this weird limbo because on the Friday afternoon, the government had announced that on the Monday, all outdoor gatherings would have been banned. So we were in this kind of limbo where we kind of had to make up our own minds about whether we played or not. And in our team WhatsApp thread, there were lots of those with insider knowledge, a few journalists and reporters and you know, people who had actually been reporting on this developing crisis, who were kind of giving long and rational explanations about, you know, how things got transmitted and why we'd probably be okay and all of that kind of thing. Ultimately, though, I was quite proud to get things over the line with a kind of rousing three-line text message about the fact that cricket, if there is any sport that is fundamentally isolated, surely it is cricket. I mean, cricket, you get fined for going too close to other players. You're doing it wrong if you get within 10 yards of another player on your own team.
What,
so I said, come on, guys,
general... here's the moment. What was the general mood on the were people generally keen to go, or was it a real sort of split?
Yeah, people were, because I think people realised that this was going to be the last time we were going to get to play for a little while. On the morning of the game, actually, someone whose wife was a nurse just wrote and said, look, I'm completely fine with playing, but my wife has just said, look, I really don't think you should. And so out of respect for her, I'm just not going to, you know, I'm not going to come and play. And we were obviously all totally, totally fine with that. It's a bit of a kind of conscience vote, something like this, really, isn't it? But on the whole, everyone was fine. I think particularly because we realized at the last minute that if we won the two games that we were down to play that day, and the rest of the season was cancelled, then, and this is the real headline, then we would take out the Sydney Eastern Suburbs Division 4 crown. So if ever the stakes were high, this was it. So to cut a long story short, we won the first game pretty emphatically. The second game was a bit closer. They were chasing about 150 and I think made about 135 off their 20 overs. But what was strange is that it sort of felt like, as I say, like cricket in limbo. You know, there were no high fives after wickets. We couldn't really share pads. We were, you know, passing around bottles of hand sanitizer rather than beer, and so it felt
that could
like
be a nice celebration,
like,
though, couldn't it? Instead of spraying the champagne over each other, you know, you spray hand sanitizer over each other. You know, you've got to improvise in these unusual times.
You do, and we rapidly actually became quite adept at doing the old elbow bumps and the foot taps as a way of you know, get when we got together in our non huddles at 1.5 meters distance from one another. We did kind of create this new way of existing as a cricket team. But it reminded me of that amazing Neville Cardus essay about the last county championship games before the Second World War. And I know that sounds a little bit kind of like a weird comparison and probably a little bit sort of fantastical. But the atmosphere that he describes of knowing that this thing is so precious is going to go on hold for a little while was kind of exactly how it felt at this point at the end of these games.
I think what's wonderful is we're all being reminded more than ever of the extent of that preciousness, you know, the extent to which people are missing this already and the extent to which those days out in the sun with your friends feel now like a real treasure and a real luxury rather than just any other Sunday.
And after 2 weeks of mostly staying indoors, I can tell you that playing corridor cricket with the cats just isn't a patch on it. From the archives. Now, a pub quiz question is always, how many ways are there to get out in cricket? And a brief conversation between Andy and I just now reveals that kind of neither of us really know. But that's not actually the question that we're going to be answering today. Instead, Andy is going to be taking us into just one of those myriad forms of dismissal. Hit the ball twice.
The striker is out, hit the ball twice. If, while the ball is in play, it strikes any part of his, her person or is struck by his, her bat, and before the ball has been touched by a fielder, the striker willfully strikes it again with his, her bat or person, other than a hand not holding the bat, except for the sole purpose of guarding his, her wicket. I hope that was clear. So reads Law 34 of the Laws of Cricket. Now, one of cricket's rarest dismissals actually has its origin in protecting fielders. So I was slightly staggered to discover that originally, and we are, you know, we are going back away here, we're sort of 17th century cricket, batsmen were free to attempt a second strike of the ball. This sounds like a recipe for chaos, and it's not difficult to imagine the risk to close fielders. 1624 at Horsted Keynes in East Sussex, Edward Tye tried to hit the ball a second time to prevent himself being caught. Tragically, he struck the head of fielder Jasper Vinal, who became cricket's first known fatality. Henry Brand was killed in similar circumstances in 1647. I mean, this is clearly madness.
So you sky it. So you sky it to, you know, top edge, pull shot out to mid wicket, and you can just run the 20, 30 yards towards the fielder, leap up and try and hit the ball before it reaches them. Well, that actually right. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, you're right, because unless you're the fielder, what it does do, I guess, is the batsman's role stops being restricted strictly to the wicket. You know, they can kind of venture forward. What I couldn't find out from either of these descriptions, you're quite right actually, is how far they ventured forth. You know, was this chipped, you know, a little bit off the wicket, or was this actually sort of ploughed into the outfield? But yet the idea, I mean, who on earth would want to field close? You know, the idea that you would attempt to catch and risk being brained by a cricket bat. So eventually the authorities, as much as there were cricket authorities at the time, introduced hit the ball twice as a dismissal. We're not quite sure when, but certainly by 1744 it was in the laws. Now, fast forward to 1906, and Leicestershire and Surrey are playing at the Oval, and we see one of the oddest versions of this dismissal. Leicestershire batsman John King struck the ball for a second time to protect his stumps. Nothing wrong with this. The laws of the game recognise a batsman's right to protect his stumps, and that's a completely legal move. He then, however, starts running, and the moment he does this, the moment he sets off on that single, he's broken the laws of the game. Surrey have the initiative to appeal, and he was given out. It's quite easy. Again, there's limited written text on this, so we're having to do a bit of imagining, but it's quite easy to imagine that perhaps this was just an instinctive thing on King's part. Yeah. I guess
squirt away, you know, down to third man or something accidentally, and you, of course, think automatically, okay, I need to run. So this is presumably based on the idea that you're able to protect your wicket, but you are not able to in any way score runs off this.
So I think that's right. And I think, you know, you mentioned earlier the fact that the last time you'd really thought of this dismissal was at school. And the little I remember of being introduced to this dismissal, that was always the context I thought of it of. So it was the idea that you weren't supposed to just gain an advantage. You know, the idea that you sort of block the ball and then thump it again was clearly not allowed. But I guess in this case, well, who knows what went through King's mind, whether he was sort of just absent-minded. But it does also show one of the oddest features of the dismissal, because actually it wasn't the act itself, the hitting the ball twice, that got him out. It was that moment afterwards, the moment where he began to run. Fast forward again to 2003, and we're in the Caribbean, and it's the most recent version of this dismissal in the first-class game, but it's very dubious whether it should have been a dismissal at all. It's a match in the brilliantly named Red Striped Bowl tournament between Barbados and the Leeward Islands. Bajan batsman Kurt Wilkinson plays a defensive shot against spinner Alex Adams. The ball bounces off the pitch and hits the toe of the bat. This very clearly does not seem to be willfully striking the ball. And I was thinking about this and thinking, this is the kind of thing that I think happens pretty frequently, actually.
Yeah, you know, the kind of old double hit. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. You know, if you particularly say, you know, it's vaguely, I mean, I guess in this case it's a spinner, but imagine it's a fairly pacey Yorker, and you jab down on it. The idea that it bounces back off the pitch again and hits your bat. Nevertheless, the enterprising Leeward Islanders chance their arms with an appeal. Now, the umpire, whether out of confusion, ineptitude, or perhaps a chance to secure his own little place in cricket history and on this very podcast, lifted his finger. The Crick Info match report concludes abruptly, Wilkinson seemed unlucky. And I wonder if it particularly grates with Kurt Wilkinson that the dismissal forms the majority of his brief Wikipedia biography.
Do we know the name of the umpire?
We don't. The DM
is the anonymous umpire has gone down in history. So anyway, his plan backfired to go down in history from this.
I don't know if you've ever come across umpires like this, but yes, both at sort of school and at the village level.
Yes.
If you appeared enthusiastically, they would sometimes just slightly panic and feel they've missed something. And I wonder if that was the result here, and it did for poor Kurt Wilkinson.
Yep.
Now, we've never had a hit the ball twice dismissal in an international game, and I was trying to think. I was thinking, what is the most likely scenario where you could see this? And this is the one I came up with. So one of the subtleties of the law is that you cannot hit a ball for the second time to protect your stumps if, in doing so, you stop a fielder taking a catch. So this goes back, you know, to 17th century and Jasper Vinal and co. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, it's just about plausible that as a test batsman, you get an inside edge off a spinner, think it's heading towards your stumps, move to knock it away when in fact it's heading into the keeper's glove. So that's the best I could do with trying to come up with where we could plausibly see this in the test game.
Yeah, and presumably, though, it leaves a degree of interpretation for the umpire in terms of whether the ball is threatening the stumps. Because if the basis is you have to be hitting it twice in order to protect your stumps, then if the ball's rolling backwards, if the umpire thinks it's actually going to miss your stumps and you hit it, then presumably they can give you out if they appeal, even if you thought it might be going back onto your stumps. I mean, there's still a bit of a grey area that's open for interpretation there, isn't there?
That is a very interesting one. I think generally the benefit of the doubt is given there to the batsman sense that I guess if the batsman... I'm now sort of adding my own caveats to the laws of cricket, but I think if the batsman plausibly was defending his stumps, then I think the best. I mean, that, you know, God, in the modern game, you could Hawkeye it if you wanted to. That would be wonderful.
I've also always been slightly confused about, because obviously if you play a defensive shot and the ball is trickling back towards your stumps, you can obviously kick it away because you can't be out LBW because you've already hit the ball. I have to say, I had always, until this feature, and maybe this is going to revolutionise my cricket career now, knowing this, I'm never going to be bowled out again after having hit the ball first. But I have to say, I always thought that was exactly what the hitting the ball twice rule was designed to guard against, was hitting the ball twice if it was going back onto your stumps and that you had to use your leg rather than your bat. So I don't know if that was just me or might be a kind of wider misinterpretation of it, but you do very, very rarely see batsmen use their bats to protect the ball from the stumps. It's much more often they're using their foot to do it.
I think that's right, and I think there's something about it that's very ungainly. I mean, I guess in the vast majority of situations, the ball is moving at a pace where, you know, say you get an inside edge towards your stumps,
your foot's just not
going to be able to react. Well, and I mean, frankly, if your foot is able to react, well done. But actually, in the majority of situations, even the idea of getting a second contact to the ball to deflect it, the ball's just moving at a pace where that's not going to be plausible. But I was trying to think again about where you might get it in the club game, and this I thought was a little bit easier, which is another lesser known feature of the rule, was you also need the fielding team's permission if you use the bat to return it to them. So I did think this was just about plausible. So the next time you're batting and say you absentmindedly knock the ball back to the bowler with your bat without asking permission, in theory, the fielding team is entitled to appeal at that stage.
And don't say you haven't been warned.
To the review, and for this episode, we've been watching The Cricket Kings of Queens. Released in January 2019, it was produced by US sports website Deadspin and directed by Hannah Kaiser, a US baseball writer. Toby, what is this film? What's it about?
So the film's really about a high school cricket team, the John Adams High School cricket team, who are participating in the only high school varsity cricket league in New York. And it follows the team through one particular season when they get all the way to the finals. And we'll talk a bit more about what happens in the finals later. So it's the story of that season. But more broadly, it's about the community that makes up cricket in New York, and particularly the immigrant community that makes up cricket in New York, following several of the kind of key characters all the way through from the uh, the coach to the star, the star batsman, and the and the captain as well. So I suppose it's really a portrait of, it's a cultural portrait, I think, as much as it is probably a cricketing portrait.
And I think we often, I guess, having grown up playing cricket in England, you think of cricket as an establishment game. You think of it as a kind of key part of the society, I guess, we grew up with. But here, cricket in New York is a migrant sport. It's what unites this with Bengali, Guyanese students playing together. And it's clearly a bit of a refuge in a time where, and director Hannah Kaiser is clearly quite keen to draw attention to this, at a time when it's not easy for many reasons to be an immigrant in America, that there's an extraordinary moment where, leaving training, one of the students walks away, sort of jokingly but slightly ominously, to his teammates, shouting, "Don't get deported," which does sort of rather set the tone.
Yeah, and it's also a picture of how cricket does adapt to kind of local circumstances, if you like. There are a few elements, you know, one of which is, and certainly this is not unique to cricket in New York by any means, but it talks about what playing cricket through Ramadan is like, what playing cricket while you're fasting is like. There's also some great footage of when they are... when they're training in the kind of school cafeteria, it must be, with you know, the fold-up tables pushed to each side. It's a kind of a hall with these pillars down the middle, which makes it a little bit difficult to see how you would...
It's kind of fascinating because it's very crummy, isn't it? They're in
it really
kind of,
is.
And it's also made more dangerous by the fact that they're playing a very intense form of cricket, you know, high-speed bowling, hitting the ball hard. What's interesting is probably the only time previously on this podcast where we've talked about New York cricket is in our review of Netherlands.
Yes.
And in Netherlands, all the pitches are really scrubby and unpleasant. John Adams High School, I don't know the name of the park, I was trying to dig around for this, but they play their games in a lovely park.
Yep.
They also play it in immaculate whites, each with their own numbers. So there's quite an odd sort of distinction on that. They train in this horrible canteen, but actually the place they play looks, you know, absolutely glorious.
Yep. And the... how did you feel that you got to know the characters? Because the film does kind of focus on, it kind of goes through episodically, almost telling the story of three or four different characters who are within the team. How well do you feel like you got to know them?
Yeah, I think we have sort of Richie, who's the Guyanese, very diligent captain. There's Alex, who's the sort of talented dilettante, a top-order batsman. We have MD, who's the joker. You have the extraordinary coach, the Uruguayan Alex Navarrete, who declares boldly early on, "My experience playing cricket is none." Richie's probably the star of things. And I think he's made very compelling by the fact that his passion for the game, but also the fact that he clearly sees him, he sees his future in terms of, you know, he talks about, "I want to get to the IPL," and you're quite quickly won over by his earnest love for the game and his desire to make the best of himself.
Well, and then that kind of slightly tragic moment where he's not the fittest character in the team, it has to be said, and he but clearly, I mean, you see him batting, and he's clearly a very, very skillful batsman, and he goes away to go to national trials, and he turns up, you know, he flies to wherever it is, and he turns up, and basically the entire trial consists of fitness tests, and you see them doing these kind of, I mean, I was watching it while, you know, lying on the sofa and felt out of breath after 30 seconds of grabs of these fitness tests, and you suddenly feel quite sorry for him that suddenly, and I don't know whether this is just an American perspective on sport, but none of it's about, okay, let's, you know, put you in the nets and see what your footwork's like. It's all about kind of generic well, fitness stuff, and I felt a bit that was sort of slightly tragic.
Well, we've talked about it on the podcast before. I mean, it often totally underrates the skills of a player, but I completely agree, there is something really sad about it, because you see them doing these like jumps, and then there's this bizarre exercise, if I was more fitness conscious I'd know what it is, where you're sort of doing a press up but then leaping from arm to arm on this board, and you see these other sportsmen kind of easing through it, and Richie not so much. There's a bit of a slightly cheeky filmmaking where Richie is moaning prior to his trial about being asked to do fitness training, and then the documentary then cuts to a shot of him drinking what I think is a milkshake, but I think I'd like to think Richie has a future in the game. I mean, aside from anything, he hits the ball phenomenally hard.
I mean, I think the other thing that comes through is how someone like Richie actually comes to life a bit on the cricket pitch. So he is the captain, and you suddenly see this young man of quite considerable kind of responsibility and. I don't really know what the words are, but when they, and we'll go on and talk about the final a bit, because that was one of the most heart in the mouth pieces of cricket I think I've ever seen. But the they go on and they lose the final, so they're undefeated all season, get to the final and lose it, and he gets the team together at the end, and he says, your character isn't defined by how you celebrate, but by how you pick yourself up. I'm not going to be here next year, but I want to see you guys in the final. And I thought that was a really kind of really significant moment for this young guy who would be absolutely gutted to put everything into winning this year. It was his last year when he was going to be playing for that team, but yet none of it was about, I've mucked up this last opportunity. It was all about how do we move forward. And I thought, well, if there was a kind of sign of leadership, then that probably is it.
And you have his mum saying, oh, you know, he's very quiet, he never says anything at home.
Yeah,
but you're quite right. When he gets onto the pitch, it's interesting, he's clearly a natural leader. I mean, his peers kind of listen to him and look to him. And the film does do well to... The cricket footage works. You know, you're able to get a good sense of the game. And as you say, the final is incredibly dramatic.
So can we talk about that last ball of the final? Because, so basically...
It's a blunder. It's a blunder.
They have so John Adams have batted first. Our heroes have batted first. They've made 130 or something, so a below par score. But anyway, they do a great job defending it. And it ends up that the opposition need... So scores must be tied. The opposition need a single off the last ball to win. Bowler comes in, bowls it. It's patted back to the bowler. You don't actually see the bats when there's a camera only on the bowler. It's patted back to the bowler. Non-striker is out of their end. All the bowler needs to do is keep hold of the ball, because there's absolutely no way the batsman's going to make it down the other end. Instead, he takes this shy at the stumps at the non-striker's end and misses, and they get through for a single. And it is one of those moments where, having been on this journey with these cricketers, you really want them to win, and you get to that last ball and you think, yes, they've done it, there's no way they can concede a single off this last ball. And then, I mean, I was honestly kind of head in my hands watching that, which I think is actually a mark of the strength of the film overall. Well, that you care so much by that last ball.
Almost all good documentaries rely on a slice of luck, and I think the bulk of the games are kind of fun to watch because the footage is fun, but they're complete non-contests. I mean, yep. John Adams absolutely obliterate team after team, and they are so lucky that they get that wonderful final game where there's also a bit of hubris nemesis to it. Like, as Richie has been actually clever enough to spot, the team have clearly got carried away with their own hype, and they don't maybe take it as seriously as they should, and they screw up their innings a bit, and then of course there's that extraordinary final moment. I think, I mean, this is a wonderful, you know, really, really beautifully crafted 25-minute film. I think in the era where, you know, Netflix and co are giving the documentary form real life and are throwing a lot of resource at it, there was absolutely no reason why you couldn't turn this into some sort of multi-episode series. You know, there's enough personality here. I actually listened to an interview with the director, Hannah Kaiser, who made the point about they had 45 hours of footage, and she was talking about things like, you know, they had Ramadan with one of the team's families, and, you know, I think you could really imagine this as the kind of basis for a much bigger, broader piece about the team and cricket in New York more generally.
So that is The Cricket Kings of Queens. It's a documentary available on the Deadspin website. It's only about 25 minutes long, actually, as Andy said. It could well be longer. And it is definitely worth a watch. Very much comes with our hearty endorsement. And that was the 122nd episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Don't forget, if you find yourself with a bit more time on your hands nowadays, you could actually listen through to the whole of Reverse Swept Radio, episode 1 to episode 122. I reckon it would probably take you about 3.5 days, but wow, what a 3.5 days they would be.
an excellent pandemic project.